Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not a long-term fix, exactly, the big European deal that was announced this morning. It's more like a plan to get a plan to get a fix. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 9th of December. Good to have you with us. And yes, here we go again. The umpteenth emergency European summit meeting, the umpteenth plan to save the single currency, the usual confusion over what it all means. And so we turn to our man, Stephen Beard, in Brussels. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So I know I've asked you this before in different contexts, but did this meeting save the euro?
No, at least not yet. Of course, the European leaders here are bigging it up and saying this is a masterpiece. Angela Merkel said it's a major breakthrough. But here's how a Belgian member of the European Parliament, Guy Verhofstadt, described today's result.
Well, it is certainly a step in the good direction because they are putting now fiscal discipline inside a treaty. But I don't think you can say that we have already saved the euro or the eurozone.
He says until we see the European Central Bank acting like the Fed, being prepared to pump vast amounts of cash into some of these most heavily indebted countries, we won't see the eurozone finally safe and sound. And he says there's nothing really in today's deal which makes this likely to happen soon.
Well, explain that a little bit. What, in the simplest terms possible, is in this deal and who exactly has agreed to it?
Okay, well, in a nutshell, 26 EU member countries have agreed to allow their national budgets to be supervised centrally by the European Commission here in Brussels, and for each country to suffer a penalty, a fine, if they overspend, if they start getting too heavily into debt. 26 members of the EU have in principle signed up to this. Britain, the 27th, is the only holdout.
Why? I mean, what's their sticking point?
Well, in a sense, Britain is playing its traditional role of being a thorn in Europe's side. Britain is the country that is always most sensitive about anything that looks like an erosion of its independence and sovereignty.
It reminds me of that newspaper headline from the 30s or 40s. Fog in the English Channel, continent cut off?
Absolutely. I mean, in this case, the eurozone has been cut off.
So where do we go from here, Stephen? What happens, you know, come like Monday morning?
Well, sadly, it seems likely the crisis will continue, but at a more muted level. In other words, this won't have been the summit to end all summits. It won't in itself deal with the debt piles of Italy and Spain. The euro seems very unlikely now to blow up and disintegrate completely, but there will surely be more panics and alarms. Sony Kapoor of the think tank called Redefine says the missing ingredient in all this is growth. Without economic growth, these heavily indebted countries will continue to struggle to pay their way.
It is remarkable to me how little conversation there is on growth in all these discussions. It's primarily austerity, austerity, austerity. What we need is a credible growth plan, which is completely missing.
And a worrying indication today of declining growth in Europe, Germany, the great economic powerhouse, said its exports fell in October by 3% due to shrinking demand in these heavily indebted countries in southern Europe.
And the euro story continues. Stephen Beard in Brussels for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
You know, for a deal that didn't quite save the euro, it sure went over well on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Along about this point in the broadcast on a Friday, we take 4 minutes and try to figure out what the heck happened in the 5 days gone by. It's our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. With us this week, John Carney from CNBC, Sudeep Reddy. He's at the Wall Street Journal down in Washington, D.C. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, John. So we're going to start with you, and I want you to test my premise that Wall Street liked this deal because why?
It showed that the Europeans had finally been able to reach an agreement. Remember, we've had all this back and forth and rumors every day of, you know, Angela Merkel is going to do this and Nicolas Sarkozy is going to do that. And they agree. Oh, no, they don't agree. Having everybody actually say, OK, here's a plan and we're all in agreement with it is a lot of progress. It's no longer, you know, the daily wake up, hear a rumor. By the time you get to work, the rumor's been denied already.
So do you think, John, that the rumors will just be less consequential, right? It's going to be a lower level of hubbub?
I think it will be a lot less consequential because we now know. We know what they're proposing to do. And we also know where the ECB stands in this. That's going to be the... Right. The European Central Bank is going to be the focus of rumors going forward because people will wonder, will they eventually have to step in and be more aggressive in buying the bonds of the troubled nations? So you'll still get those rumors, but we actually have a concrete plan, and Wall Street likes that.
Yeah. Sudeep, you were just over in Europe. Treasury Secretary Geithner was traipsing around over there, and you were along for the ride. How was he received? I mean, what are they thinking about what we're thinking, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, well, he's received in a different way in different places. In Germany, he probably has a much more difficult response and difficult situation because they don't really like this kind of outside pressure and outside influence. In France, the French are looking for a partner, and they love Obama, and they're looking for somebody to help push them along. What the Treasury Secretary was trying to do is build some momentum through what you could call a subtle form of pressure and offer some ideas to mediate between all these factions in Europe. He was in five cities talking with officials from four countries over 3 days. I wish I could say he really broke through with a big achievement, but the reality is that people know what they need to do in Europe, and they know how crazy they look to the outside world at a time like this, but this is how sausage gets made.
Yeah, do they really understand how completely, I mean, it's just weird what's going on over there, right?
It is really weird. I do think they recognize that this is creating chaos in markets. You can't, whether it's our markets or theirs, you see what's happening. And even they recognize that this is going to be a painful inching along to the ultimate solution rather than one big bang that gets us where we want to be.
Yeah. John, assuming the Europeans will now be better off, does that mean we can breathe a sigh of relief here a little bit?
We're all used to falling from one crisis into the very next. But this actually does look like good news. We need a strong Europe. We want their economy to do well. We sell a lot of stuff to Europe. A lot of our big institutions depend on Europeans who do well and invest in America. So this is good news for us if it works. And so I think we should all sort of breathe a sigh of relief here.
Sudeep, you buy that? I mean, are they breathing easier at the Treasury Department and at the Fed and all that?
Well, the key phrase from John there is if it works. And with a lot of these things, we've seen them fall apart the week after they get announced. And in this case, there was a lot of talk about the bailout fund, the money that's needed here to build a firewall against Italy and Spain and all these troubles. And we just don't know where they're going to get with that. And it could certainly fall apart in the next week. And we'll be back to where we were with chaotic moves in markets all weighing on economies around the world and threatening to bring us down again.
Well, let me ask you that. And very quickly, John, the last question goes to you today. It's if this thing falls apart Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, will that be worse than if it had continued to be so tense? You know what I mean?
I think it will. We've built up very big expectations right now for, you know, this is the program. This is what needs to happen. Anytime if we get some, you know, finance minister coughing and saying, well, you know, we're not really going to put all that money into this.
Right. Then
the markets will react very badly to this.
Yeah.
They've committed to it. If any sign that it looks like, you know, Germany or France is backing away from it, there'll be a big, big problem.
All right. John Carney at CNBC. His blog is called Net Net. Sudeep Reddy at The Wall Street Journal in Washington. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
One imagines with the news of the deal today that Europeans are breathing a tad easier about the prospects for their financial futures. But if the polls over there are to be believed, the economy is not what they fret about the most. Poverty is higher up, as is climate change. And that takes us from Brussels, 6,000 miles south, to Durban, South Africa. The UN climate talks are wrapping up there. They've knocked off for the night. No deal yet, but there have been some important developments over the past 2 weeks. The meetings have been going on, and the Europeans, wouldn't you know, are pushing hardest From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Now in the wee hours in Durban, the Europeans are pushing for what they call a roadmap toward a binding climate deal by 2015. They have two new allies, the poor countries and the island states. Both stand to suffer the most from rising seas and unpredictable weather. In the undecided column, Canada, Japan, the U.S. Nick Robbins at the bank HSBC thinks they're willing to talk.
But they want it on the basis that the major emerging economies, the China, India, and Brazils of this world, also come in.
The emerging economies are still buying their first cars and getting electricity, so they don't want to cap the emissions too much too soon. Still, China did signal it could agree to carbon pollution caps, with the familiar caveat if the U.S. goes first. Meantime, the United States has gone from the potential savior of the talks 2 years ago to the perceived laggard today. Here's David Wasko of Oxfam America.
They played a blocking role in terms of the financial resources that are so critical to developing countries and also to brokering international agreements.
The horse trading will go on through the night. They've already scheduled meetings for Saturday morning. What if there's no deal? Jennifer Haverkamp is with the Environmental Defense Fund.
Just last week, Mexico passed a climate law through its Senate. Australia has a new climate law. The South Africans came out with climate policies. So not all the eggs go in this basket.
A basket that may start to fray. Without a new deal, the carbon pollution caps on the books now expire at the end of next year. Those caps apply to all the rich countries except ours. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, say, is that an electric motor in your race car?
It's kind of a little bit of element of flipping the bird to the oil companies.
Why, yes. Yes, it is. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 186 points today, 1.5%, ended at 12,184. The NASDAQ up 50 points, nearly 1.9%, 2646. The S&P 500 climbed 20 points, 1.2%, signed off at 1255. Thanks to today's rally, markets end the week in the black. The Dow Industrials gained 1.4%. The NASDAQ nudged up 0.8%. The S&P 500 added nearly 1%. Financial stocks rebounded. Morgan Stanley and Citigroup deposited more than 3% today. DuPont was the only blue chip that sat out the rally. The chemical company said it expected weaker earnings because of sluggish demand for industrial supplies. Stocks slid 0.3%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.06%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for November. As U.S. troops withdraw from Iraq, President Obama is scheduled to meet with Iraqi Prime Minister Nuri al-Maliki at the White House. And a House Small Business Subcommittee holds a field hearing in Woodstock, Illinois. It will hear from local businesses about their reluctance to hire new people. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Just because they don't have enough controversies brewing over there, Europeans are tinkering with a new source of energy that here in the States, at least, has been plenty contentious. Natural gas fracking is becoming more popular in Poland, in particular. It's raising the same environmental worries it has here, with a dose of geopolitics tossed in for good measure. Christopher Worth reports.
In the far reaches of rural Poland, I meet Arkadiusz Urbanek. He's an engineer with Orlen Upstream, one of Poland's state-owned oil and gas companies. And together, we climb to the top of a drilling rig that's boring a well nearly 2 miles into the earth.
We have to drill 24 hours, 7 days a week, 965 days a year. We cannot allow to keep this rig doing nothing.
This is just the first out of 100 wells Orlen plans to drill for shale gas. That is, tiny pockets of gas, Urbanek says, are trapped deep within the rock below.
So we have to stimulate this rock to get the proper flow to the well.
To do that, thousands of gallons of water are pumped into the ground, along with chemicals that break the rock. It's a process called fracking that sparked a shale gas bonanza in the United States. Poland could be sitting on a lot of shale gas, as in 300 years' worth of supply, and it's become a centerpiece of its strategy for economic growth.
The real future for the whole country is the shale gas.
That's Mikołaj Budzinowski, a deputy minister at Poland's treasury. Behind him is a large map of the country's sprawling shale gas deposits, many of them bought by big American companies like Chevron, ExxonMobil, and ConocoPhillips.
I would like to stress that the Polish government right now is aspiring to become the leader of shale gas extraction for the European Union.
Turning Poland, or so the plan goes, into a major exporter of gas in the region. Paweł Proprawa, an expert on shale gas at Poland's Geological Institute, believes it could create 100,000 new jobs across the country.
We will certainly see billions and billions of dollars being invested each year in Poland in production.
The Polish government wants to use the proceeds to fund things like public pensions. The dream is that children like the ones crowded around this street organ grinder in Warsaw can retire very comfortably someday. But not everyone in Poland is so eager about shale gas. Jacek Benarski of Greenpeace Poland says protests have erupted in some communities where drilling is underway.
I must tell you that we are a bit scared because the risk of water pollution together with chemicals. Look what happened in the United States in many places.
France banned fracking earlier this year over environmental concerns, and some in the EU have proposed European-wide standards for shale gas extraction. But Poland vows to veto any new regulations. That's because this is about more than just money. It's also about energy independence. Today, Poland buys most of its gas from Russia, an old nemesis known to turn off the tap in the dead of winter when political disputes arise, a situation Poland would like to avoid. In Poland, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We start our letter segment today with my conversation from yesterday with philanthropist Eli Broad and his idea that lessons from the world of business can help improve education in this country. Sharon Phillips of Lake in the Hills, Illinois, says she's tired of people who aren't teachers judging those who are.
These business people look very ignorant when they go comparing the U.S. to other countries and even to itself 20 to 30 years ago based on average test scores alone. Wake up. Things have changed.
John Eck teaches criminal justice at the University of Cincinnati. He says private funding to reform public enterprise can work.
In the 1970s, the Ford Foundation invested in police reform through its creation of the Police Foundation. Today, policing is far more effective and a great deal more fair because the Police Foundation broke through the entrenched interests that stifled police innovation.
We started a new partnership with Gallup this week, a series we're calling Attitude Check. Frank Newport's the editor-in-chief over there, and he told me, among other things, when we spoke earlier this week, that there is no greater interest in narrowing the gap between the rich and poor in this country now than there was 20 years ago. Kim Bruno of Washington, D.C. grants that Americans probably don't begrudge the rich if they got that way on the up and up.
But if the individual or organization achieves their economic gains through fraud or unfairness, you will hear howls of anger, particularly when the new or old rich use the law to protect their dubious gains. Americans want a fair shake.
A correction now from our story about ratings agencies earlier this week. S&P, Moody's, and Fitch are the biggies. They are private companies, not started by the government. You can rate us. Be kind. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. GM says it's going to miss sales targets for its whiz-bang new electric hybrid Chevy Volt. 8,000 sold, probably, not the 10,000 they wanted. A government investigation found Volt batteries can catch fire if they're damaged in accidents. GM has offered to buy cars back from nervous Volt owners if they like. But Alex Chadwick discovered, Volts aside, there are still plenty of people happily battery-powered.
All down its long, rippling Mississippi border, ghosts still linger from Missouri's frontier past. So, a pioneer gearhead techno-geek gathering sort of makes sense here, led by the Daniel Boone of electric cars.
We're trying to get liquored up here, play with a little high voltage, and go for a drive.
Jack Rickard is holding a 16-ounce souvenir from the Stag beer truck that's parked on the taxiway outside his own big private hangar at the Cape Girardeau Airport. Happily, Jack's not actually driving, but others are.
We basically enjoy racing cars.
Mike Bream, one of 160 attendees at the first ever electric vehicle conversion conference. Basically, they take normal cars, they strip out the engines, and replace them with electric motors and batteries. And you're thinking, earnest, sensible greens. No, not these guys.
These cars are going to, in a very short period of time, outperform in just about every aspect gas-powered vehicles.
These are car nuts, visionary tinkerers, obsessed hobbyists, engineer entrepreneurs, and many of them sound as though they're just fed up with the way things are. Ron Adamowicz brought an electric dragster.
I feel our money should stay here in America. The batteries don't come from America, but they come from a good country, at least a country that's not trying to kill us. So I don't like foreign oil, plain and simple.
Okay. Actually, we get most of our oil from countries that are very happy to sell it to us. Doesn't matter. That's just how these people feel. Jack Rickard.
It takes a little bit of effort, but you go in your garage and you make your own damn car. And it's kind of a little bit of element of flipping the bird to the oil companies.
Sure, you could get a Nissan Leaf or a Chevy Volt, but the conversion crowd here really wants you listening in your car to join them. And you just might if the cars are really cool, which they are. When the all-electric kit car Porsches, the classic 356 body, drag race a quarter mile down the closed taxiway, ripping up to 80, the G's will shove you back in your seat. Someone brought a converted World War II Jeep. There's a less glamorous 90s-era Ford pickup. Really, you can convert any car for $12,000 or $20,000 or $30,000. How much car do you want?
This is one thing that an individual can do that's not like recycling grocery bags. You can actually do something. An individual can take a car they like, convert it to electric, and it works as a car. They're not out anything. It's not a science project.
Jack was also an early internet pioneer. He can afford to bankroll this gathering. But for many of us, there are other considerations in gas to electric conversions. A mechanic friend notes, if you wreck one of the kit cars going fast, you might as well be wearing a potato chip. And sure, they're electrics. But if the power comes from coal-burning power plants or Jack's generator, how green is that? And there was that memorable PowerPoint slide from one of the presentations, the top five reasons our cars catch on fire. And that was before the news of the Volt. If electrics are really going to go anywhere, someone will have to make a better battery. In Cape Girardeau, Missouri, this is Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
Alex Chadwick is the host of the new public radio series Burn from Sound Vision Production. Special thanks to the National Science Foundation. You can check our website. It's marketplace.org for a video of those ultra-fast electric cars.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note to put a punctuation mark on the last 5 days, the news that didn't quite make the headlines. It comes to us, as it always does, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Jennifer Collins, reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about cuddle class.
So would I. If I knew what it was, what is it?
Okay, so Air New Zealand has this new seating arrangement. Basically, two people pay for three seats. They, you know, lift up the armrests, and then they can cuddle by laying across all three seats.
That's very sweet.
Yeah, except for now flight attendants are having to be trained to break up amorous couples.
They weren't before?
Apparently, yeah.
You're already packed pretty tight on most flights. You end up almost necking with somebody whether you want to or not.
Matt Berger, digital director for Marketplace. What's your story?
New York University announced that they're coming out with a class called Occupy Wall Street.
Isn't the whole point of Occupy Wall Street to eliminate class? So this seems counterintuitive.
That is a good point, but it's a real class. And it's offered by the school's social and cultural analysis department.
Okay.
And it's going to focus on the history of debt and finance.
And, of course, one of the qualifications for getting in the class is going to debt to be able to afford to take the class.
Jonathan Karp, senior editor. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
We're going to be talking about a story in Slate about how in Virginia you can't start school until after Labor Day.
Why? That's a law? Why?
Yeah, they passed a law because they said it will hurt tourism if you start school before Labor Day. And apparently they have a very strong lobby from the amusement park industry.
So basically, if students went back to school, they couldn't be earning money off of them, you know, riding rides.
They'd be earning money, that they wouldn't have teenagers to work at the sites.
Maybe they could just come to a compromise and start school early, but actually hold classes on roller coasters. Right?
Right. That would teach them a lot about our markets.
There is more where that came from. The radio show that Brendan and Rico do is called The Dinner Party. There's a link on our website, which is called marketplace.org. The radio show is called Marketplace, just plain Marketplace, from APM American Public Media, and it's that time. We got to go. The Dow picked up 186 points, about 1.5% today. The NASDAQ jumped 50 points, nearly 1.9%. The S&P 500 climbed 20 points, 1.2% today. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yor is the vice president and general manager around these parts. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money. If you're a parent, how do you tell the kids that you're cutting back for the holidays? Well, here's a start.
We will do a list and we'll go through it. And I go, no, no, no. Okay, maybe.
Santa's on a budget, gang. I'm Kai Rizal. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.